Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A Catholic walks into a Mormon church. The bishop says, "Why the long liturgy?" Oh, all right, that wasn't the world's funniest religious joke, but it does speak to one of today's topics of discussion. What happens when a Catholic religious journalist attends a Mormon religious service with notebook in hand? Is it a clash of cultures? Or is it just the same old, but with less caffeine and more jello? We have answers to those eternal burning questions and more, as I'm pleased once again to be joined by my favorite religious journalist, Jeremy Lott, who recently penned an article in the July and August edition of the American Spectator entitled, "Stranger in a Mormon Land." While that will be our lead-off topic today, we will take the conversation in many other directions, perhaps some unpredictable, because Jeremy has the enviable position of being the editor for RealClearReligion.org, which is the finest aggregation website for religious news out there, and it also features many original articles that you do not want to miss. This gives Jeremy the ability to see the whole panoply of what is the religious world, and one of the reasons I like having him on the show. Jeremy also serves as the editor of other RealClear sites, including RealClear Science, RealClear Books, RealClear Policy, and just the plain old RealClear, which has lots of stuff presented, well, real clearly. In addition to all this, as well as his penchant for appearing as a superhero at minor league baseball games, Jeremy is a prolific writer, having appeared in over 100 publications ranging from Reason Magazine to The Guardian newspaper. And he also has 4 books to his name, including the most recent, which was a biography of William F. Buckley, delightfully entitled William F. Buckley. All of this stuff will be linked on our website for your perusal and approval. Finally, I should note that today's interview is extra special because, unlike past chats we have had over the phone, Jeremy joins me live and in person from the Match Coffee and Wine Bar in the ever-expanding metropolis of Duval, Washington, where I've recorded a few other interviews previously. So a big shout-out to the folks at Match Wine and Coffee Bar, and if you're ever in need of choosing a vacation destination, Duval is the place to be. Jeremy, good to have you back on Research on Religion.
Always fun to be here.
Hey, so you've been up to a lot of stuff. You've creating and managing this new Real Clear site, yet you still have time to appear as a superhero at minor league baseball games. What's that all about?
Well, there was I regularly go to the Bellingham Bells baseball games, and they had a superhero day recently.
And who did you show up? Did you come as Carlos Danger?
No, I did not. I was Captain America.
Oh, okay. That'd be better than Carlos Danger. So,
yeah, slightly, you know, less damaging to my reputation.
I would guess so. But Carlos Danger, I don't know. That's the going name nowadays. So I think that's a pretty cool name to have. Did the Bells win that game?
Yes, they did win that game.
Okay, so you are good luck.
Yes.
Oh, awesome. All right, well, this whole thing of showing up to places in disguise seems to be a recent theme in the media and for you recently, so which brings me to this recent article that you penned for the American Spectator, "Stranger in a Mormon Land." Now, if I'm correct, you're a converted Catholic from a Baptist upbringing, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And here you go showing up at a Mormon stake, which, for those of you who are not familiar with the Latter-day Saints, is basically the equivalent of a parish or a congregation. So what's up with that whole showing up at a Mormon stake thing?
Yeah, well, the deal was if you can cast your mind back to last year, all journalists were going on about a Mormon moment, and you know, people in religious journalism were duly rolling our eyes about this, but you know, it was the phrase that everyone was using,
and I remember from past podcasts with you did not like the term Mormon moment.
No, okay. But I was willing to accept it when an editor put it into an ebook that I did. So there's that.
There you go.
Yeah. So everybody was writing about Mormons like they knew something about Mormons, and most times they didn't. I knew a little bit about Mormons. I'd done a lot of reading. I talked to several Mormons, etc. But I thought, you know, maybe I should actually go to a Mormon church, quote unquote, and, you know, see what this is all about, and just kind of take my notebook and experience what they had to show me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so where did you do this?
It was in Bellingham. I went into Bellingham, Washington, and it's the I don't even know if the I got the term right, but it's the usually the geographical area is called a stake,
right?
And the individual churches are called wards.
Oh, that's right.
But,
that's right.
But it's a little more complicated than that, because sometimes these houses of worship can have multiple wards, and it's just very confusing for all of us non-Mormons.
That is right. I made the mistake of saying stake earlier on here. The ward is like the parish or congregation. And it's true that, and we've learned this from previous podcasts with Michael McBride, and we'll link to some of those, that once a ward gets to a certain population size, they split it off.
Yeah.
So oftentimes there'll be two wards essentially in the same building.
Yes, that's correct. Or they'll have a sort of subject-specific wards. Like I believe that several of the youth in Whatcom County are in the youth ward, if I understand that correctly.
Okay.
I'm just spitballing on that one.
Okay. Yeah, we are not Mormons here. We're not Mormon experts, but we are looking inside, peering inside this Mormon church to see what is going on. This is up in Bellingham, Washington, which is, describe to people where that is.
Bellingham, Washington is within a spitting distance of the Canadian border. It's in Whatcom County, which is the westernmost county in Washington State. And if you look at Whatcom County, Bellingham is sort of the granola-eating part of Whatcom County. And it politically balances against North Whatcom, which is the sort of bastion of conservatism. And there's interesting political fights as a result of this.
Yeah. Bellingham is the home of Western Washington University. So that's why...
In Fairhaven.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you do this? You did this in Bellingham, but when did
you do it? It was last year. I want to say it was in September.
So this is before the presidential election.
Yeah, that's
so
correct.
When the whole
but it was while the Romney thing was definitely percolating.
Okay, so the Romney thing was percolating. There's lots of talk about Mormons in the media. Why? So you decided just to go see what this is about. Did you call them up in advance saying, "Hi, I work for RealClearReligion.org"?
No,
right?
I showed up with a notebook so people could see I was taking notes and.
Wow.
If they asked, I said, "This is what I'm doing."
Uh-huh.
And
so was it a large notebook? Was it pretty easy to see?
It was. I mean, it wasn't huge. It was a little reporter's notebook. But,
okay.
You know, and I wasn't trying to play gotcha journalism. I was just trying to paint a picture for people who've never been to one of these things what this looks like, and you know what are the interactions there are like, and that's what I proceeded to try to do in the article.
And so you walked in the door, and I can imagine. I know the Latter-day Saints are a very tight-knit community. You walk in the door, they must look at you saying, "Huh?"
Yeah, they could definitely tell I was not I was an outsider.
Okay. And did they come up to you and say, "What is that notebook in your hand?" And was it warm?
They were a little bit more. They were fairly nice, warm people. You know,
okay.
So you know they come up, they'd introduce themselves, and then they'd ask about the notebook, and I'd say, "Well, I'm a journalist, and I'm just here to just see what this is about."
And they were cool with that.
They were fairly cool with it. At one point, they have like the church and then the Sunday school portion of the thing. After the church, then there is a Mormon missionary who was very aggressively trying to convert me, and that didn't go as well as he wanted it to.
Okay, so you're still Catholic,
yeah.
But you had this experience. You walk in there, you got your notebook.
Mm-hmm.
Did you sit in the front or the back?
Closer to the back.
Closer to the back. Okay, that's usually where first-time attenders always sit in any church too. So you're sitting in the back and taking notes. So what'd you find? What was this experience like?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things I'm used to from both Protestant and Catholic churches is images in the church, in the chapel itself.
Images such as,
you know, pictures of Jesus, or there's a cross, or some, you know, there's stained glass or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Mormons, they're not iconoclasts. They're not against images, but when it comes to worship, they exclude all of that.
Okay.
And so it's a very simple thing that focuses your attention on the word that's being preached, or I guess on, you know, they have a loft for people to sing from the choir. But I mean, it's very much now if you go out in the hallways, they have all kinds of sort of 1950s pictures of Jesus and this sort of thing, and they're not against that, but they just think as part of the worship experience itself, they want to focus people more on the word.
Wait, what's a 1950s picture of Jesus? Is he like riding in a Corvette
he's
or
got,
something? Or?
You know, it's yeah. No, I didn't mean. I'm just what I meant was that you've seen like the old Bibles from that period that have pictures and how they would show Jesus and the disciples, and that sort of art is how they're depicted at Mormon meeting places.
And was it an older building like that, or is it a fairly new church design?
I would guess it was constructed in the 80s or late 70s.
Okay, so it has that kind of typical 1980s.
I mean, it got over the worst of the late 60s, early 70s architectural disasters, which we can get to in a bit.
We'll
but,
talk about that.
You know, it's a fairly, I mean, it's meant to be a plain design.
Okay. So you're sitting there. That's one of the things you notice. There's not much imagery as much as you're used to in other churches you've been to, especially Catholic churches that love the stained glass and such. What are things stuck out to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things you notice just from watching the interaction between the congregation and the people, the bishop or the stake president, is this is really a religion of earnest amateurs.
Earnest amateurs? What does that mean?
I mean, they don't pay any of their clergy, right? And so what you have is businessmen, usually, who are doing this part-time and who are just basically just a little bit better studied than your average Mormon in the pew, and very much just trying to work insights from their own lives and their religion, and not none of them are claiming any very special competence for this.
It's interesting because last week on our podcast, we talked with Michael McBride about religious leadership, and he has a lot of experience with the Latter-day Saints. And this is one of the things that he mentioned as well, too, is that there's a rotation of individuals who are essentially volunteers. They get called to their service, and the congregation willingly approves of them, and then they give of their time. And you're right. A lot of these folks at the grassroots in these wards don't have a lot of theological training, so to speak, as in going to a seminary. They've been going to the ward for a long time, attending religious services.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Mormons, they'll go to their wards growing up and learn a lot of stuff there. It used to be just men, but now more women, will go and do two-year missions, and so they'll have some theological training for that. So everyone is more educated in their religion than most average religious people are.
Right. Yeah, we're gonna get to that because there's a second part to the service, as you talked about the Sunday school, which is not the Sunday school that your typical Protestant or Catholic would be thinking of. So, but let's stick with the first service. So you got the person who's up there leading the service. What was the service like? Is it like your typical Protestant service? Was it what was the theme? Do you remember anything from that?
Yeah, I mean the message he delivered was about, how you shouldn't get too involved in Facebook and you should focus more on your family and stuff. But not, he said, I'm not saying don't use these things. I'm just saying prioritize the things that are important.
Mm-hmm.
That was half of the message. And then the other half, because this was around that time, was talking about Mitt Romney's, not his candidacy, but interest that this had awakened among a lot of people, and how outsiders view Mormons. And he said, well, when they think of us, they think of close-knit families, and we believe in Joseph Smith and polygamy, which we don't believe in anymore. And he went down the list, and to the greatest extent he could, he turned all the criticisms on their head and said, look, these are good things. These are, if to the extent that these are distinctive to us, good for us.
Mm-hmm. And I remember at this period of time, too, just driving around here in the Seattle area, I saw a lot of billboards that had the I Am a Mormon campaign, which, I mean, the church, I think, rightfully was saying, okay, we're going to be in the news a lot. Let's make sure that we present who we are to the news, and that's a very legitimate thing.
Yeah, and but so, no mm-hmm. other religious body would ever think of doing something like that.
Yeah.
Mormons, what they realized is Mitt Romney is... back up here. Evangelicals were hurt greatly by their association with George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
They were seen as too political, too partisan, too a lot of things, and it hurt them in many ways in terms of their public image, in terms of outreach. It was not good for them. Looking ahead to this, they haven't stated that this is why, but I believe that the leadership in Salt Lake City said, we need to find a way for people not to just think of Mitt Romney when they think of Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
And so they launched this incredibly expensive I Am a Mormon campaign where they just show off hundreds of their members that are as diverse as you can get and have interests as varied as you can get. And what they do, you walk them through their interesting lives, and then he says, and I'm a Mormon,
mm-hmm.
They wanted to show people that Mitt Romney wasn't the only kind of Mormon you can be.
Mm-hmm.
Even while they never distanced themselves from Romney or anything, they wanted just to show people that, there are a lot of different kinds of Mormons, and the door's wide open for anyone who wants to come in.
And this is pretty interesting that this is happening the day that you're there. You're saying this is in September, so we're roughly a month, maybe a month and a half away from the election.
Yeah.
And some guy shows up with
Salt
a notebook.
Salt Lake City, very clearly said there will be no politicking in our churches, and we'll bounce bishops who do that, et cetera.
Okay.
There were some reprimands and things like this, but for the most part, the bishops and the stake presidents obeyed the diktat and didn't do politicking in churches, but that didn't mean that they couldn't, clear up, talk about the campaign and how this was being viewed by people and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was, entirely appropriate for what they were trying to do.
And you don't think this was done because there was some Catholic with a religious or with a journalist notebook?
I don't think they did this just for me.
Okay. Right. And they didn't point you out saying, oh, that really yeah, that outsider guy. Okay.
Ding, ding, ding.
Okay. So they, they're talking about that. And you only went that one time. Is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Did you get a sense that this was an ongoing theme that for the next, month and a half leading up to the election, we're going to talk about what it means to be the Mormon Church and how we put the face on the Mormon Church when everybody's looking at us?
I didn't think it was going to be like a regular sermon series, but my sense is, probably once or twice more before the election, you'd hear something about Mormons in the press and Romney and whatnot.
Okay, so they're talking about don't be on Facebook so much, spend more time with your family, and when you hear the stuff about Mormons and on the news, this is who we are. Was there anything else? I've never been to a Mormon service. I have a lot of friends who are Latter-day Saints. Is it liturgical at all? Was it just... I've had the experience of being at very liturgical Catholic services, very liturgical Episcopalian services and Presbyterian services, as well as non-denominational Protestant services where you sing and talk all the time.
Yeah, I mean, there was... It seemed organized, but I wouldn't say it was organized into a liturgy. I'm trying to remember. They didn't have Bible readings, and that's what you tend to have typical of liturgy.
Yeah.
So I would say no, this is not liturgical.
Okay. And did you get a sense that that was just because they were spending how long did it last?
It wasn't that long. It was like an hour.
About an hour. So typical religious service, and it seemed mostly sermon, not... Did they do any singing?
Yeah, they did some singing. Yeah. They've got decent... They had all the congregation singing. They had a solo. They had a piano as well as an organ. None of the modern trappings of modern Christian music with guitars and stuff.
But everybody playing Chris Tomlin. That's what I'm used to now.
Yeah.
So okay, all right. So you sit through the service for an hour, taking notes. It finishes up. Then what?
Then two things happen. First, the Mormon missionary has a run at me and. Then I figure out which class I'm supposed to be going to.
Okay, well, let's start with those two things. The mission Mormonary has a go at you. How did this happen? Were you walking out the door and they grabbed you and tackled
what? He asked me about the notebook in my hand, what I'm doing, etc. And so I say, I'm just here taking notes because I'm a journalist covering this. And I would have thought that would have been the end of it. But instead, he decides to then start going into my religious background and asking, you know, but, you know, have you ever looked into joining, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Aha. Uh-huh. So they're turning the questions around on the religious journalist
yeah.
here.
Ah, okay. And, you know, one of the big things that Mormons will say is, well, have you ever prayed about this? You know, if you ever pray about this, God can tell you if it's true or not. I think it's a little more complicated than that, but and I said, you know, he said, well, you know, if you pray about this, I think God could really tell you it's true. And I said something on borderline dismissive. As I recorded it in the piece, it was, yeah, I'll get right on that. You know, I wasn't trying to cut him, but I also didn't really want to continue to have this conversation.
Right. Yeah. It's one of those awkward moments that you need to get to the other thing. And this is something, too, that I learned from your article, is that religious services for the Latter-day Saints are broken off into two chunks. You have the Sunday service, which you went to. They talk about Facebook and that kind of stuff. And then they have a Sunday school.
Yeah. Right?
That's the next
And that's
thing.
Broken into several different sections, like a lot of Sunday schools are.
Okay.
And I went to what you would kind of deem the beginner Sunday school.
Okay, so was there a listing out there, like on a big piece of paper, this class here or that class?
Yeah,
there?
They had something about, you know, like the priesthood class here, you know, this sort of thing. And
okay,
and you know, I didn't think I should probably be going to a priesthood class because I didn't think I got much out of it.
Yeah, okay. So which class did you choose?
It was I'm trying to remember the name of the class, but it was the beginner's class. The okay. Mormon principles or something like this.
Okay. And you go into a separate room. How many people were in there?
I'd say, you know, something like 15 people, including the teacher.
Okay. And how did that go down? First of all, how long did it last? And what were some of the things that you found out there?
Yeah, it was a little bit over an hour long. And he just marched us through the section that day of the sort of the Mormon story. And you know, why they're right and everybody else is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to me. Mormonism is fast. I learned more concretely than I'd known before just how true this is. Mormonism is a really fascinating mix of the Protestant critique of Catholicism and the Catholic critique of Protestantism.
Mm-hmm. So both of those things in there.
Yeah, because what the Protestants say is, you know, the church got off the rails. It lost any claim to legitimate authority, and you know, it never recovered it. And so but Jesus gave us principles for living, and we're going to go and do that. And thank you.
Okay.
And Catholics say about Protestants that, you know, Jesus came to start a church. It's still here, and you can come in anytime.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay.
What the Mormons say is, well, the Protestants are right about the Catholics, that there was this sort of great Constantinian fall, but that the Catholics are also right about the Protestants, because you need to have apostolic succession, and Jesus really did come to establish a visible and continuous church that had authority and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joseph Smith happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, that by direct revelation, God was able to reestablish all of these things.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard that interpretation before. And oftentimes that comes from individuals who are outside of the tradition, can oftentimes pick up on these subtleties or maybe even not so subtleties that a lot of folks within the tradition might not. And so that was rather interesting. I have to ask you about that too, because I've had this experience doing field work in my own research. I'd sit in different churches and talk with different people, and the outsider being there always creates a different dynamic, right? Did you pick up any sense that when you walked into this class of 15 or so people, somebody says, whoa, there's the Catholic journalist guy there. Let's say something different.
I mean, I don't, you know, a few things might have been said differently than would otherwise have been said, but I intentionally didn't interject myself during the class because I was conscious of that possibility. You know, I just went along with it and answered as intelligently as I could when they'd ask questions. But
so you were participating in
the class.
Very cool.
They would give everybody, you know, this passage of from the Book of Mormon or from the Doctrines and Covenants to read. And so, you know, they'd be helping him tell his story, and they had a flannel graph and all these other really great, like...
A flannel graph?
Yeah, I mean...
What's a flannel graph?
That was like a blast from my Baptist past. You know, it's where you take, like, a board that has flannel, and you take, like, little figures, and you can kind of stick them to
it.
Oh,
felt!
Yeah. Oh, sorry, that's what I meant.
Felt graph. Okay, yeah, flannel graph. We're up here in the Pacific Northwest, which is lumberjack territory, yeah. So I was thinking this, the graphics of a flannel shirt, but felt, yes, oh, yes, the felt graphs.
Yeah, you know, that. And, like... Yeah, here's how, like, the authority was established, and, you know, you put all this stuff together, and here's how it was taken apart, and here's how it was put back together.
Wow.
And it just reminded me of growing up.
And that's funny you said that. Since I grew up as a Catholic, I remember going to Sunday school, and we had the flannel things. Or not the flannel. Now I said it.
Yeah.
The felt things,
yeah.
Right? And because they stick together really well.
Yeah.
Cut in circles and shapes like that. So it's not just a Baptist thing.
Okay.
Not just a Catholic thing. It can be a Mormon thing as well. So felt. Very useful for religion, as we find out.
Yeah. It turns out they have a deeply felt religion.
There you go. Deeply felt religion. Okay. So in terms of that, you weren't sitting back in the corner outside.
No, I was, when it came to the class itself, wow. There were a couple of rows. I was sitting in front.
Okay. And what was the composition of this? Was this... looked like new families, younger kids, older.
It was a total mix of people. You know, they had some. I mean, you know, there was like the teacher was like a early 30s white guy, and his wife was from South America in some place. There was a black lady. There was, you know, some younger people. Not like anybody really ancient, but there was a few people that were older.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty good mix.
So you do that class, you find out some of the principles. That's
yeah,
another
hour. I did actually at the end of the once class was over. Then I went up and had the one of the things that the teacher said was that he was talking about the Nicene Creed, and
uh-huh.
And he said that the Nicene Creed is just incredibly convoluted and impossible to understand. And you know, every bit of me wanted to challenge him in class, but I looked back to when I was a terror of a college student, and I tore down a bunch of professors, mm-hmm. And I just decided I really shouldn't do that here.
Yeah, us professors don't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it probably wasn't the best thing to do as the outside journalist observer.
Well, it's, you know, I'm asking questions and looking for answers and not really, anyway, so when I waited until everybody was gone, and I walked up and I go, okay, I'm Catholic. I understand that you don't believe in the Nicene Creed because you're not Trinitarian, I get that, but what is so hard to understand about it? And it just kind of rocked him back, and he didn't expect that. And so then we struck up a conversation, and we talked for another, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes. And he said to me that, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, either we're right or you guys are. And then he thinks about that for a second, and he goes, please don't quote me by name.
Okay, we will leave that name off the table. But that, I mean, that's a good answer. Either you're right or we're right.
Yeah.
So after that second hour, yeah. did you just pack up and leave, or did you hang around?
I said a few words to a few other people, but and just kind of looked around the facility for a few minutes and then took off.
Were people still seeming to hang around? Because they, you know, as you talk about now, people have been in church for 2 hours, which
yeah.
You know, for me is a pretty long time.
Yeah.
But was anybody else hanging around?
Oh, yeah. Or? There was quite a few. I mean, not in the class. They were going off and doing other things. I'm sure there were other things that were going on at the building that day. I just wasn't. I'd gotten my fill of church for the day.
Yeah. Yeah. 2 hours can be pretty long. So what's your big takeaway from this? Oh, actually, before I ask you that, one other question. This was in September, a month and a half or so before the election.
Yeah.
Was there any buzz that you heard in the hallways about, oh, you know, Mitt Romney's running? Or was there any, I know political discussion was tamped down during yeah. the actual services.
No, they weren't. I mean, I heard maybe a couple mentions of Romney, but nothing, you know, like that wasn't a big part of what they were interested in or excited about. This was clearly just, you know, they were interested in their religion, and you know, he
was
related to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so what was the big takeaway that you had from this? So you went in there, and you come back out, you get to reflect upon it, and again, you're writing this article roughly, about 9 months after.
Yeah.
So it had a good time to gestate.
Yeah, no, I said, I thought it made me kind of have more sympathy for what it's like to be a Jew. in a church.
Okay.
Who's never, I mean, just the, you have these people that, you know, use your holy book, but they have these other books, and they have a different ways of interpreting it, and they affirm the truth of your religion to a point, but they have a supersessionist religion that says that they have, you know, a fuller truth than you do. And, yeah, I finally understood a little bit of what that might be like.
Hmm. Very interesting. Looking at things from the outside. And yeah, that's actually a pretty good way, I think, of looking at it. And again, the article that you wrote in the American Spectator was entitled, what was it entitled again?
Stranger in a Mormon Land.
I should remember that. So we will point folks back to it because it is a really interesting read. And it's a fun thing to do. I think for folks that are interested in understanding the religious landscape, it doesn't hurt to every so often just pop your head into another place and say, hey, what you guys about, because we can learn a lot about each other that way. Now, speaking of religion and your own religion, you have that Catholic background, and one of the other big stories this past year that you have posted a great deal about on realclearreligion.org has been about this new guy called the Pope. And Pope Francis, they call him. And I'm saying Pope Francis because I've been chastised thoroughly on Facebook for calling him Francis the First. So I'll leave it at Francis. But as we were discussing before, he is Francis the First.
Yeah.
Why is that? I want you to defend me on Facebook.
I'll defend Tony here because it used to be the first pope to have a name wasn't designated as the first until the second came along.
All right, so if some guy chose the name Urban, one of my favorite pope names of all time, he would just be Pope Urban until the second guy comes.
I really thought you would have preferred Pope Rural.
Pope Rural would be good.
Pope Rural, yes. Rural, I can't say that right.
Country.
Yeah, Pope Country, yeah. or Pope Southern.
Pope Southern, there you go. Pope Southern Rock.
Yeah, no, but the John Paul the First called himself John Paul the First during his pontificate. Admittedly, that only lasted about a month, but still.
Yeah.
He did call himself the first before the second came along. And so Francis has called himself the first. I'm just saying.
Okay, so for all you folks that were dogging me on Facebook about this, maybe you can be right and maybe we can be right. We'll just agree to disagree, I guess.
That's right.
Pope Francis the First is okay. So we've had about 6 months now. Yeah, it was about 6 months. Yeah, or so, of this Pope Francis, mm-hmm. who appears to be becoming known as the humble pope, the pope of humility. I will carry my own luggage. I will
pay my own bills. I'll make my own phone calls.
Exactly. So what's up with this guy? As you reflect upon him, both as a journalist and a Catholic,
I think he's humble. I'm not knocking that in any wise, but I think a lot of what's being passed off as humility here is he's just sick of people. I mean, he's talked repeatedly about how he doesn't want people programming his schedule. Like, he's got all these secretaries that they're always trying to tell him where to go and what to do. And a lot of times these are just his little ways of getting away from that and saying, no, I'm in charge. You're taking a back seat. I'll do this myself.
And that's kind of interesting, right? As we would think that normally, somebody who's backing away from this is trying to get away from the hierarchy. But you know, what you might be saying is he's trying to reestablish his authority.
Yeah, I mean, he said this several times. In fact, it was touted as his humility that he wasn't living in the papal apartments right away. But he's talked about this, and he said, "Look, a big thing is I don't want all these people around me constantly programming everything that I do." And one of the ways of getting around that is I'm not living in the papal apartments, and so I don't have that many people in proximity to me who can try to do that.
Okay. Well, what's your reflection otherwise on this guy? I mean, he doesn't want people programming him.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool. On the other hand, I thought, you know, if I was in that position, and somebody could just like run my life and tell me where to be all the time, and I could eat good food, I think I'd like that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What your thoughts on his leadership?
His predecessor was quite deferential.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Lawler, he's a Catholic journalist, and he gave I thought this was actually a really good example. Benedict was a cat person. He really likes cats, and he was told that in the papal apartments there are no cats.
Uh-oh.
Well, okay, as Pope, you can just snap your fingers and change that.
Yeah.
Instead, he deferred and said, okay, I guess there aren't any cats in the papal apartment. I mean, he just completely deferred to
Really? So he didn't have cats in the papal apartment?
Exactly. You know, I mean, he was told that that's the way it's supposed to be, and so he shrugged and said, okay, I'll go along with that.
Wow. Yeah. I did not know this.
Yeah.
I've seen pictures of him with cats, because in his office he had a cat.
Yeah, no, he really likes cats, but he was told, we don't allow them, and instead of saying, I'm the Pope, you bet we allow them, you know, he deferred to it.
Okay.
And, yeah, I mean, so there are some... there was the foot washing thing, right, where Francis did a foot washing at on Maundy Thursday at a youth detention facility rather than in, you know, the basilea or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, criticized by conservatives because, oh my gosh, there were a couple of women whose feet he washed, and according to the canons, that's not allowed. It's a widely overlooked canon, by the way. But
really? You cannot wash women's feet because their feet don't get dirty? Or what?
It just has to do with how this is supposed to be a recreation of the Last Supper. And,
I see.
You know, okay. There's a historical precedent for, well, it's all men, and so that's what you should do. Now, again, this has been basically ignored in the past, widely, except by the Pope. And he finally just said, well, I'm ignoring it too, so there goes the canon. I mean, I don't know if they've rewritten it, but there's no way it could ever be enforced after that point.
That's true. So Pope Francis, by washing the feet, is basically insisting on cats can be in the papal apartments, in essence.
Yeah, in essence.
Okay, so is he a cat lover, do you know?
I don't know. I think he's more of a dog guy, is my guess.
Okay, well, that's cool. We have both cats and dogs, and I kind of like dogs enough. So what else is going on? We're recording this now in late July. It's July 26th when we're recording this, and so Pope Francis the First, or just Pope Francis for you, those of you who want to, you know, get upset about that kind of stuff, is out in Brazil now.
Yeah, and for World Youth Day.
For World Youth Day, and that's creating a bunch of hubbub. You get to see all the news on this stuff. What's going on?
My favorite one. I think this actually was unintentional, but I could see it being intentional. The Pope Mobile took a wrong turn in the middle of this crowd.
Yeah,
and they just got stuck there because the crowds just wanted to crowd around the Pope and not let him through. And finally, the Brazilians decided to clear the way with tear gas.
Oh, there's nothing better than the papal procession with tear gas, I guess. I don't know if that violated canon law. I wonder if they're checking tear gas. Can we use that? It actually is quite amazing that when he did take that wrong turn, and you can see how maybe the person who's driving the Pope Mobile or their security detail would be freaked out about this, because he's in the city and the streets are fairly narrow and there are just millions of people coming out to see this guy.
He's very, very popular.
Yeah.
I like him a lot. I don't quite understand the thronging, but, you know, I understand why people like him.
You wouldn't be part of the throng. So if he came to Lyndon, Washington,
I would find the tallest building in town.
And wait for him up
there?
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because I can't stand crowds either. And so I don't know. If I had ever been elected the Pope and I was driving around the Pope Mobile and saw millions of people around me and we took a long turn, I think I would just screaming.
But, I mean, this is fairly typical for him in crowds. He'll dive into, I mean, doesn't mosh, but, I mean, he'll dive into crowds and glad hand in ways that just popes just didn't do in the past.
Yeah.
And his security, by the way, I've been told this just drives them nuts. There's also this story about how the Swiss guard was standing outside of his there was a Swiss guard standing outside of his apartment, right? And he walked out and said, you know, you've been standing all day. Here's a chair. You can sit down. And the Swiss guard said, no, I'm not allowed to sit down, right? And so then Francis goes back into the apartment, makes the sandwich, walks back out, and says, you're going to sit down and eat the sandwich because I'm the Pope.
Oh, well, finally, there he's asserting his authority. That's what Benedict should have done with the cats, right? I love that about him, because I think I'd be the same way. If it was the president, you have these Marines who are trained to stand perfectly still for 8 hours, and that's essentially what the Swiss Guard are trained to do.
Yeah,
you're driving me crazy doing that. Come on in and let's have some nachos or something, right? So you said you have a pretty good feeling about this Pope, and speaking as a Catholic, what's your vibe on him theologically? Is he going to make some big changes in the church? Is this guy? I mean, it's funny because
he's very well educated. In many ways, he's a traditionalist, but he's got a very good pastoral sense. That's something that Benedict didn't really have. He was a good preacher, very good, and good at relating to crowds that way, but he just it wasn't, you know, he'd never been a parish priest or something.
And that's one of the divides have come up, because I noticed when he was first elected, a lot of people were saying, oh, he's a progressive pope. No, he's a conservative pope. And you have these two sides of the church kind of competing. And I figured, well, after a month or two, they're going to figure this out. And the conservatives are not going to like him and the progressives are going to like him, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And that really doesn't seem to have shaken itself out.
So. No, I mean, if you look at the way he's come down in several different controversies, he clearly is, quietly a conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look
in,
at the...
In what ways?
So, well, I'm in the sense that, in the Catholic sense, that, you have the women religious in the United States that were under investigation for basically being a bunch of activists rather than being nuns.
These are the nuns on the bus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go round and round, round and round, round and round. And, there was a question of whether or not the inquiry and was allowed to go forward. And he said, yeah, let's do this. Let's continue this. Let's, make sure that they're being nuns rather than being activists, you know. And there was a lot of progressive uproar over that. But
that's, for me, that's kind of interesting, because it's not so much of a political statement. What he's basically saying is that, listen, we're about God, we're about Jesus,
yeah.
We're about the church, and that's what we do. We're not about debating things in the halls of Congress,
because yeah.
that's why you have a Congress.
Yeah, in his country, there was the financial crisis hit, one of the surprising things that he and company did was they simply reiterated the catechism, and they said what we are called to do is to live faithfully.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is going to shake out however it shakes out. We don't think that whatever political activism we could engage in here would actually make a difference. And they didn't.
And that seems like a straightforward thing.
When you'll get him sounding progressive is when everyone could agree with him. Where he, like, there's a bunch of people that died in a factory that didn't have a bunch of safeguards that they should have because somebody decided to cut on costs, you know, and he'll denounce rapacious capitalism. And it's kind of hard to disagree at that point.
Yeah. You know, lots of people dying in a factory where the windows are chained shut is not a good thing.
Yeah.
So
suboptimal.
So that makes sense in terms of that. One of the things that he has to deal with, even though he's very religious, very thoughtful, wants to get back to the pastoral mission of the church. The church is a very large hierarchical institution.
Yeah.
And it has dealt with a lot of political issues. One of these has been a fairly publicized scandal, financial scandal involving the treasurer of the Vatican. A lot of intrigue in this thing with flying airplanes at night from Switzerland. What's going on here, and how has the church dealt with that?
Yeah, I mean, what is going to happen is eventually, I believe this will occur, they are going to abolish the Vatican Bank.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like Ron Paul is very happy now.
Yeah.
Okay, they're getting rid of the Vatican
Bank. I mean, it's not an institution that's up to modern financial standards, and for various reasons, it probably never will be. And so then the question is, can they live with that, or are they simply going to do away with this and do away with the scandal that goes with it? And I think that he's edging toward just doing away with it entirely.
And so this became maybe a golden opportunity to do a little bit of institutional reform and say,
hey,
you guys, you can't be flying, millions of dollars in suitcases from Switzerland. Yeah. Let's just get rid of the Vatican.
I also will not be surprised if he takes about a third to a half of the Vatican bureaucracy and sends them packing, not sends them pink slips, but grabs the priest and says, "You're from this country. Go back and serve there."
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if in a year's time you didn't see that happening.
No, that'd be very interesting. Is he giving some indications of doing that, or is it just your gut feeling?
There's been a lot of whispers in Rome about this, and some of the indications he's given point in that direction.
What are some of the other things that have been occupying his time over the past 6 months?
Well, I mean, one of the big deals is the allegations that there's a gay lobby in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, there is.
He just acknowledged it.
And just, forthrightly said, yes, there's a... And this has created... I think it was the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Worship had a very scandalous gay past and had to be shown the door. And he went through the normal vetting process, and this wasn't brought to his attention at any point because a bunch of people were covering this guy's butt. And, you know, he doesn't like that and wants to see if he can push back against that sort of a thing.
And again, this sounds very much like his basic leadership personality is saying, listen, we're going to be straight above the board. This is how the process runs. You know, sorry about this guy, but that's how it is, right?
Yeah. I mean, on a related but different subject, you know, when he was a bishop and he was dealing with the issue of priests that, you know, had mistresses or whatever, he'd say, look, I'm willing to be supportive of you as a private citizen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll do what I can for you. Or you can, I'm willing to forgive this if you want to put your mistress away. What I'm not willing to do is to let you live a double life.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's really straight and above the board. I mean, yeah. There's a set of principles that you're living by, and it seems like he is living by it. What about, in terms of you hang around Catholics because you're Catholic and you go to Catholic Mass. What's the buzz around the people that you talk to? Are they liking this guy? Is this guy a big, you know, refreshing change? Are people thinking like this is the guy who's going to set the new standards for the church? What's your feeling for the future here?
Most church-going Catholics, as far as I can make out from my limited sample size, like the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Think he's a good pope. Thinks he's pushing the church in the right direction, roughly. Well, they might disagree with him about this or that thing. And that seems to be just the general thing. Now, you'll get progressives who will bitch about him being somewhat conservative, or conservatives who complain that he's like too pastoral, basically, and just not as interested in culture warring. But, you know, most Catholics are pretty happy with the guy.
Sounds really good. Well, what about anything else that you have seen with your seat as the editor of Real Clear Religion? Are there any other major trends that you're seeing in the religious media that jump out at you that I'm missing or that other people should be aware of?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that you're seeing in the Baptist world right now is Rick Warren, whose son committed suicide, has had a major... He's trying to get behind a lot more funding and whatnot for and awareness about mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the guy's got a really serious platform, so I think he might make a difference.
And this is an issue that we brought up in an earlier podcast with Tom Rainer about this. And it is an interesting challenge for a lot of folks in the religious community, I think, too. And I'm wondering if you're picking up on this tension in that, you know, the suicide of Rick Warren's son, very tragic event. And people start talking about, well, maybe we need to think more about psychological approaches to mental health rather than spiritual approaches. In fact, in some of the circles that I travel, a lot of people have been very critical that Baptists and evangelicals say, well, our approach to mental health is just get Jesus. If you get Jesus, you're good. But maybe some people are saying, no, maybe we need to think about...
I think Jesus might disagree.
Jesus might disagree on that. So, I mean, are you picking up that evangelicals are starting to think, well, maybe professional psychologists might have something to say here in the church?
I mean, possibly. I think if anybody could push them to it, Rick Warren is... You know, if you got like Rick Warren and maybe John Piper and a few other people seriously pushing in this direction, then it might make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll see how that works.
Definitely something to be looking for here. Another thing, and this is something that's been bugging me for a while, but there's been a increase in talk about religious nuns recently, and I believe we talked about this in the past on one of the podcasts that we had together, is that people are talking about, oh, the religious nuns are just increasing rapidly here, and that
this is N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S.
Not the nuns on the bus,
yeah.
But these are the N-O-N-E-S.
They're diminishing.
Yes, the nuns, N-U-N-S, are diminishing, but the N-O-N-E-S, they are increasing. And that story, which I first heard maybe about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, has really picked up traction in the last year. What's your sense looking at the media, how it's covering this? What are you seeing on that front?
Look, statistically, you know, there's something to this, but it's not nearly the huge trend that people are making it out to be. A lot of it has to do with simply more accurate survey data that, you know, a lot of people were considered de facto Protestant basically, for a very long time. And as we've gotten more accurate survey data, that looks different. The thing is, with a lot of these people who say they have no religious affiliation, then you start asking them about the religious beliefs. These are not a bunch of Richard Dawkins wannabes. You know, they actually are sort of generic Protestant Christians who simply don't claim a religious affiliation.
Yeah, they just say, you know, I'm good with religion, but I'm a little bit busy this Sunday.
Or sometimes they actually say, sometimes they'll ask you, do you have a religious affiliation? No. Do you go to church? Yes.
Uh-huh.
Just slapping your head and going, you're an idiot. But no, I mean, in their defense, there was a bunch of, they've done surveys, they've asked a bunch of people, like, are you an atheist? Yes. Do you believe in God? And a significant portion of them say yes.
It sounds like me taking surveys, right? I'm usually playing internet pool or solitaire while they're asking questions. I'm like, yes, no, and I just ask those questions. But actually, it's interesting. You mentioned that some of these folks, they ask, do you have a religious denomination or affiliation? They'd say no, and they say, do you go to church? And they say yes. I'm one of those idiots because I belong to a church where we're non-denominational, and we're increasingly hearing that denominations are less important than our love for Jesus. So I did this at a conference recently in Michigan, and we played around with a little questionnaire, and I said, if somebody called me up and they said, what denomination do you belong to? I would say none. And I'd say, none? Yeah, you're one of the nuns. And then if they asked me, do you go to church regularly? I'd say, yeah, of course I do. You know, and not as regularly as my pastor wants, but, and so I would end up in that nun category, but it kind of befuddles it. And it seems that there is a movement afoot within Protestantism, at least, that there's a downplaying of denominationalism.
Or even Protestantism. I mean, one of the reasons the surveys look the way they do is because there are a lot of Protestants who won't self-describe as that. They'll say, I'm just a Christian.
Yes, exactly. And so it becomes...
Or I have no religious affiliation, so it sort of waters out a bit.
Well, we'll have to see how this stuff plays out in the media over time. And I know a number of people are jumping on top of it, saying it's the decline of American religiosity, but I tend to be very skeptical of it.
To the extent that that's true, it's true among the younger, you know, millennials or whatever the group after them.
Yeah, the millennials have picked up big attention recently, too.
And you know, I've gone on about my theory on your podcast before for why this is the case. You had an awful lot of flight out of cities, and churches followed the people in the last generation. And now you're seeing increasing urbanization, and you don't have the church infrastructure in place that you used to. Mm-hmm. Now, as that infrastructure catches up, you may see some catching up of millennials.
Yeah, churches like Mark Driscoll's, Mars Hills, are finding new places, new fertile ground within urban areas. So we'll see how that goes, too. The other thing I think, and since we had this discussion several months ago, one of the things I thought about was that millennials are getting married later.
Yeah.
They're getting married in their 30s and even their late 30s. And it's usually when you as a 20-year-old, I don't need church anymore because I'm, you know, bulletproof, essentially. But when you get married, and especially when you start having children, that's when you start drifting back. And with the average marriage age starting to move higher and higher, and people delaying childbirth until later and later, it's not surprising that you're finding some of these folks just not going to church.
Yeah, have you interviewed Mary Eberstadt on your program yet?
I have not.
She wrote a book recently about, and I'm trying to remember the title of it. It's not coming to me, but... The thesis of her book is that the decline of, not in America, but the decline of religion in a lot of countries was fueled by the decline of the family rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to have to get her on the podcast then, on your recommendation. Well, we're running close to the end of our interview here, and I want to close on a rather difficult topic for us to discuss here on Research on Religion.
It's ugly. It's ugly.
It's an ugly topic. You know it's an ugly topic. How ugly topic? It's ugly churches.
That's right.
It is ugly churches. And it's difficult to talk about because, well, we're an audio formatted program and ugly churches tend to be rather visual. Nonetheless, your website, Real Clear Religion, recently posted not one, but two, count them, two, rather lengthy lists of the world's ugliest churches with full color pictures and everything. And so we're going to link to that on our website. And we want you all to go and visit this, but we're going to try to do the best we can because I love these two stories.
Warning, you might want to wear some sunglasses.
You might want to wear, yes, absolutely. So listeners, go and do that. But I want to kind of talk a little bit about this and do the justice as we can in terms of what we can do with an audio format here.
Yeah.
Some of the ugly churches, and I went through these. You did one story on this, and then readers sent in more ugly pictures.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I think Real Clear Religion editors got it right first. Some of the ugly churches that the readers sent in were pretty ugly, but not as ugly as the ones that you got. And I will invite our listeners to send in ugly pictures on our Facebook page. Go there. And
yeah, we're very happy to continue to highlight ugly churches.
Okay, so this might be your new mission in life, is to highlight. And I have to say, given that you are a Catholic, I noted that the plurality, I don't think it was a majority, but the plurality of ugly churches happened to be Catholic.
Yeah, I actually almost want to call for the Pope to issue an apology for all the ugly churches.
It should be. So what are some, and actually the other thing I noticed too is that a lot of these were built roughly between about 1950 and 1980.
Yeah.
And tell us about some of these.
Well, one of these would be the Third Church of Christ Scientist in Washington, D.C.
I love this one.
Mm-hmm. This is a big blob of block of concrete. It is so horrible and so ugly that its parishioners have for years been wanting to tear it down. And the D.C. city government does not want to allow this because it's an example of an architectural style that's almost extinct, known as brutalism.
I love that term, brutalism.
And so eventually this thing will be brought down by, you know, right-thinking Christian Scientists who just think this is the ugliest thing ever. And it's at least very close.
And it's a great story for me because I'm very interested in how churches react to or interact with local governments. And here's a church that says, our building is really ugly. It's a blight on the community. We want to tear it down. But the government steps in and says, uh-uh. You aren't going to do that.
Yeah.
You don't have the right over your own property to tear down something that's really, really ugly. Yeah,
absolutely. And the most bizarre church we found was something called the Kapal Matha Church in Uvari, India.
This I have to agree.
Can you please describe this one for readers? Because they might not believe me, Tony.
There are a number of ugly churches out there, but this is possibly the ugliest one. And again, we'll link to this on our website. It's the very last one. I think you have 36 pictures or 36 churches, and this is number 36 on the list. It's a boat with an airplane on top of it. Or maybe it's an airplane with a boat underneath it. I'm not quite sure.
Could go either way.
But I can't even understand how the services are conducted. I don't know if they're conducted in the boat part or in the airplane part, because I don't really
I assume the baptisms are in the boat.
Yeah, the baptism must be. Maybe just throw people over the side. It doesn't even look like there's water.
Walk the
there,
plane,
though.
Get a baptism, same difference.
It is one ugly beast here, but there are some other ones here. A lot of them are in Europe. There's one in Finland that actually looks
like a bomb shelter.
You guys labeled it as a bomb shelter. My description looks like a UFO crashed into a mountainside, and there's just lots of rocks and rubble surrounded by skyscrapers. You got to go see that one.
Yeah, that could work too.
Another one of my favorite ones is this one in Japan. It's the Harajuku Church in Tokyo, Japan, that looks like it's designed by the folks who did Hello Kitty.
Yeah, that seems about right.
And one would wonder why church attendance in Japan is so low, but if you just showed this picture, you would quickly understand why that is the case. A few others that came up on this. One, it's not just exclusively Europe, although Europeans have not been very good in churches here, but there's one in Vacaville, California, which is Cowville, for those of you who speak English. It's called the Father's House, and describe what that one looked like.
Oh, yeah, that's one of these storefront churches that basically, the sign looks an awful lot like the church version of a Ross's Dress for Less.
Yeah, it does. You have storefront churches, which I appreciate, and you have a few pictures of those on the ugly churches, and I kind of felt sympathetic for them. It's just, you know, low-budget church finding a dumpy spot where they can pay low rent and get people in.
We tried to pick storefront churches, that there was something about them that really set us off. This one is the fact that it really does look like a Ross's Dress for Less.
It does. It's a big box store kind of church that actually has the sign.
Yeah.
It looks like a Lowe's, Home Depot kind of whole thing, and people are flowing into that. There's another one in there, which actually surprised me, and I got to turn our listeners to this, because this one was in Florida. And when I clicked on the link, it came up, and I said, wait, why is this on here? It's really nice. It looks like a Spanish mission-style church. It's beautiful tile. I actually like the church. I said I would go this, but there's something odd about that church.
It's the Chicken Little Church.
It's the Chicken Little Church, and that's how you labeled it. And I scratched my head, and I went, huh? I don't, what? And then, but if you stare at the picture long enough, lo and behold, Chicken Little does appear.
That's correct.
So it's very interesting. One of the other ones that actually was sent in by the listeners, or your readers, I should say, was the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City, Mexico. And I have to say that I actually was a visitor of this church, and you describe this as a stadium-style church, which is how actually their own website, I think, actually describes them. I went to look at their website earlier this morning, and they say, yeah, stadium-style church. It's actually next to a very old mission-style church, but because of the earthquakes in Mexico City, it's been damaged, and they moved over to this new church, which does look like a stadium for a basketball team. One of the most interesting things that I noted, and you didn't have this on your website, was that the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe actually celebrates the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is a very important religious icon in Mexican Catholic history.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the first appearance of Our Lady in the New World is the idea.
Exactly. And so it has a lot of historical significance. And they have this relic there of picture. It's behind bulletproof glass and everything. The strangest thing that I found when I went and visited this was that you were able to take a moving sidewalk, or like one of those things in those airports where you stand on and it moves you, a people mover, and you would go by there and you would get to see it. But what's interesting is that people were worshiping down there in the central sanctuary, and it was kind of strange. It would be like having a church in an airport where people are moving back and forth with you. I felt rather uncomfortable by that.
But
there were other churches like that. Again, one of my other favorites was this one in Cordoba, Spain, which is the Iglesia de Consolation, I think, or Consolation, I should say. And it looks like, I don't know, describe this one, if you could.
I don't know, kind of maybe a Mac computer.
It looks like a Mac computer. I think on the website it mentioned it was like a drive-in theater.
Yeah, that was.
It could be either
that
one.
That was Nick's idea. We went back and forth, and I decided to let him have that one.
The weirdest thing, though, is not only the outside of the church is very strange looking, but the inside of the church was very looking.
It looks haunted.
It looks haunted, because if you're sitting in the pews and you're getting a little bit bored with the sermon and you look upwards, what do you see?
Ghosts, basically.
Basically ghosts. And you had the funniest description there. It says it looked like there was a nuclear bomb exploded and the shadows of these people were burned on the ceiling. Folks, you've got to see this. We are going to link to these on our website. And you got to visit realclearreligion.org to see these sites. And if any of you have any additional pictures that you want to send in, you can send them to realclearreligion.org, or you can just send them to our Facebook page. And we'll link to that as well. But other than that, ugly churches.
Very, very ugly churches.
Very, very ugly churches, and you should all check that out. So, ugly churches, Pope Francis, and going to Mormon services. That's what we've covered today with Jeremy Lott. And Jeremy, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.